Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I want to also echo my thanks to all of you for coming and my admiration for your devotion to vengeance, which is my topic for today. I'm sure it's actually devotion to truth and wisdom. So to come in spite of weather shows that you really love truth. You really seek wisdom. I'm gonna give you my title and then introduce with a little bit of Socrates, and we'll eventually get to the Sermon on the Mount. But in between that, we're going to talk about vengeance on a more natural level, you might say, which I think is foundational to what our Lord then teaches in the Sermon on the Mount. So my title is It Wrong to Want the Bad Guy to Suffer? Subtitle, A Christian Approach to Vengeance. Plato wrote a dialogue called Gorgias. Gorgias was a famous sophist teacher, after whom the dialogue is named. And in this dialogue, we have Socrates, who is trying to convince a student of Gorgias. The student's name is Polus, trying to convince a student of Gorgias, basically that he's on the wrong track. Socrates tells Polus that when we harm someone, that is when we say, kill someone, or banish him to another country, or take his property. We do it, Socrates says, for the sake of what is good. Hence, we don't simply want to, it's a quotation, we don't simply want to slaughter people or exile them from their cities and confiscate their property as such. We want to do those things if they are beneficial, but if they're harmful, we don't. So Socrates is saying that nobody really wants to do these things to another human being for their own sake, but we might choose them for the sake of some good to be accomplished through death or banishment or confiscation of property. Now, what makes this an interesting conversation is that Paulus is not convinced, and he says, quote, "Really, Socrates, as if you wouldn't welcome being in a position to do what you see fit in the city rather than not. As if you wouldn't be envious whenever you'd see anyone putting to death some person he saw fit, or confiscating his property, or tying him up." End quote. But in fact, Socrates doesn't want to do those things, and he doesn't envy people who have the power to do them, even if they happen to be doing them legally and justly. That we don't want these things, not for their own sake. When we have to inflict something painful on another human being, Socrates is convinced these are the things that no sane person wants in themselves, but only if they're beneficial. And we don't envy people for having the power to do them. You know, we might recognize some people have the responsibility, say, to put other people in prison. But we don't envy that power, Socrates says. With regard to the peculiar kind of satisfaction that comes through perceiving the one who has wronged us now suffers, now experiences pain, Socrates seems to have no sympathy with that reaction. And in this, at least according to the Plato scholar Gregory Blastos, Socrates was really a radical. That is, he was going against the whole moral sense of the ancient Greek world. Blastos says, this is a longish quotation from Gregory Blastos on Socrates' rejection of retaliation. So he says, quote, "Harming one's enemy to the full extent permitted by public law is not only tolerated, but glorified in Greek moralizing. The sentiment is ubiquitous." Solon, who is one of the famed wise men of the Greek tradition, Solon, aspiring to good repute among all men, prays that he may be, quote, "sweet to friends, bitter to enemies." Medea, in the play, in the myth, scorning the role of feminine weakling, determined to be as strong as any male vows that she will be harsh to foes, gracious to friends, for such are they whose life is most glorious. End quote. So this is traditional Greek morality at Socrates' time, doing good to your friends and evil to your enemies. And this is not considered, it's not looked down on. This is actually considered not just excusable, but actually good, virtuous. So Socrates is departing from this ethic of vengeance, if you like, by asserting that it's actually never good to do evil to anyone, friend or enemy. A good man does good to other people. A just man does just things, makes others more just. However, Socrates is not rejecting the authority to punish people who have done something wrong, but he argues that when that happens, when someone inflicts harm on a wrongdoer, like when you put someone in jail, for example, for theft, we're not doing evil to that person. So to harm someone by punishing him is not to do him evil. It's actually to do him good, surprisingly. If one is actually good to the wrongdoer, then one punishes him. It would actually be doing him wrong, doing him evil, to not punish him. This is another quote from the Gorgias, so Socrates speaking to Paulus. He says, "You maintain that evildoers are happy if they escape punishment, but I claim they are the unhappiest of all, and that those who are punished are less so, are less unhappy. For I think that you and all the other men, as well as myself, hold it worse to do than to suffer wrong, and worse to escape than to suffer punishment." End quote. So with this, Socrates is introducing what has been called a therapeutic image of punishment, right? Therapeutic or medicinal. Aristotle also is going to affirm this in a certain way, but we won't have time to get into that. So this is the view that punishment involves inflicting something painful on a wrongdoer, which is really meant to heal something, either to heal his own wrongful state, you know, to help make him more virtuous, or maybe to heal the whole community of some wound that it has suffered through the wrongdoing. Or if not to heal, if that's impossible, at least to palliate, you might say, to lessen the bad effects of the disorder, or sort of contain the cancerous growth of the evil that has been done. Socrates is right there thinking of punishment in this way, not as harming or wanting to inflict pain on people. And we also have to note that to inflict punishment, in Socrates' view, cannot be motivated by hatred, right? Those who really understand what they're doing, they truly understand good and evil, they understand that by inflicting punishment, they're actually doing good to someone, not doing evil. So if they really hated the wrongdoer, they would stop punishing him, because that would be worse. It would be worse, in Socrates' view, for him not to get what he deserved than to be punished. Now, we might suspect, some have suspected, that Socrates is doing a little bit of sophistry on us, ironically, because he's arguing against the sophists, because he's turned harm into good and non-harm into evil. But I would say instead that Socrates is really trying to unearth what's behind Solon's saying that, you know, he wants to be sweet to friends and bitter to enemies, that Socrates is getting underneath that to something more basic. And that is this idea of equality, that in justice, we want to give what is due, but what is due is not always the same, right? Equal doesn't mean same quantity in all cases. It means equal things to equal persons, or what is due to one may not be due to another. So the general idea that when one person suffers an injury from another, there is a kind of inequality that's created through that injury. You know, so someone steals my wallet, I have lost something, the other person has gained something. So there's an inequality that's been created. And the way to reestablish equality, or at least to move in that direction, would be through some restitution or repayment. But it's not simply restitution. So there's a difference between restitution, which is giving back, like if someone stole your wallet and then says, "Oh, I'm sorry, here, you can have your wallet back." That's simple restitution. But retribution is something more. So usually we don't just say, can you please give me my wallet back and think that everything is fine. Usually retribution involves something more than that, right? Because it's not just a matter of getting back the physical stuff, right? It's a matter of getting back the order and the safety. You know, so long as I walk around thinking anyone can take my wallet anytime he wants, I'm afraid. I'm living in fear and paranoia, and I don't have that freedom that I had before I was robbed. All right. So restitution is good, but retribution is also good and sometimes necessary. So I think Socrates is actually agreeing with this traditional idea that there's something due that's paid through punishment, but he rejects the idea that it's evil, right? He thinks evil is not due to anyone. Good is due to all, but different goods to different persons. And to someone who has done something evil, right, the good that is due to him is to receive a punishment, whereas the good that's due to someone who has, say, done a virtuous thing is perhaps praise or some sort of reward. But in both cases, it's a matter of giving something good to someone. So much for Socrates. Now, I think to most of us, Socrates' view seems correct, certainly better than Solon's view of being sweet to friends and bitter to enemies. I would suggest, though, that insofar as we think that's obvious, we're actually relying on a Christian insight that even in our somewhat post-Christian culture is still present, kind of in the water, that, yeah, we ought to be good to everybody, brotherly love. We ought to, even if we have enemies, we ought not to just will evil on them or do bad things to them. Sure. We'll come later to the explicitly Christian foundation of that. But I wonder if we are so consistently moved by this sentiment, are we always repulsed by the idea of being bitter to enemies, or only when we heard it said so plainly? I looked up on Wikipedia. Avengers Endgame was, at the time it was released, the highest grossing film of all time when it was released, which I don't know when that was. It was just a few years ago. Avengers, right? It's all about vengeance, but it's fantasy. So, I mean, maybe we're more okay with vengeance if it's in the realm of fantasy rather than reality. But that seems to me to say something. It says that even if we deny it in our public discourse, we do have this kind of inner desire or satisfaction in seeing people who do wrong get punished, right? Whether they're human beings or titans or demigods or whatever they are. We feel some sort of satisfaction in this. So what I want to argue first, before getting to the Sermon on the Mount and the Lord's teaching on this, is to think about this just philosophically and naturally. I want to say that actually this reaction that we have that evil should be punished, that's actually a natural and therefore a good reaction. It's not the highest thing, but it has a certain base level of goodness. But I also want to say that Socrates is right. Socrates is correct that the good man never does evil. And then we'll turn to what the gospel has to say about all of this. So, first of all, vengeance itself or retribution. It might surprise you to know that among the more than 20 different virtues that St. Thomas Aquinas includes under the cardinal virtue of justice, you know, in the Summa he organizes the virtues around the four cardinal virtues and the three theological virtues. So, and there are many dozens of sub-virtues under each of those. So under justice, one of the virtues that Thomas Aquinas talks about is the Latin name is vindicatio, and it's often translated as vengeance. So vengeance is a virtue. Sometimes it's translated in a more recent translation of the Summa as retribution. Is this really a virtue? What can that be about? Like all the moral virtues, this virtue consists in a mean, so a middle ground between two extremes, an excess and a deficiency. So vengeance or retribution would be the virtue that chooses the mean, the right amount of punishment. You know, so something has been done wrong, you know, it's not minor, it's something significant, and needs to be punished. Not going to the excess, which is called cruelty. Cruelty would be an excess of punishing or an excess of desire to punish. And also not going to the extreme of deficiency. So one can actually be, as St. Thomas says, too remiss in punishing, like not punishing at all where it needs to be done. And that can be out of fear or human respect or other motives. But choosing the right amount of punishment is not absolutely identical with wanting the bad guy to suffer. We could at least, in imagination, think of someone who had no emotions, right? Like a Vulcan judge who simply by reason determined, okay, this is the right amount of punishment and that's what is being chosen without any sort of passion or emotion. But that's actually not how we normally operate as human beings. So our actions, including virtuous actions, are accompanied with and often are necessarily tied to emotions, passions, as St. Thomas calls them. And that's actually part of the fullness of a moral virtue. So an act of vengeance that was emotionless, that had no passion, would actually not be the ideal. It would not be the ideal because it would be, in some respects, less than human, right? Being utterly without feeling. Now, it might be a surprising claim, but I think there is some intuitive support for this. If you think about an act that is described as cold, calculated revenge, right? If you think about cold, emotionless, like, don't we sort of think of that as worse than someone who takes revenge, say, in a moment of passion or with anger, right? Maybe even a moderate amount of anger. It almost seems like cold vengeance is more likely to be cruel than vengeance connected with passion. At any case, this emotion of anger, which is the emotion that wants to take revenge or to punish wrongs, is at root related to a natural inclination, or something that's natural to us as human beings who are animals, right? Rational animals. So a natural inclination is the tendency that something has simply by virtue of the kind of thing it is, right? So the nature that it has gives it certain tendencies. Like we have a natural inclination to food and drink. We have a natural inclination to reproduction of the species. We have a natural inclination as rational beings to know the truth. We also have a natural inclination toward, quote, removing what is harmful. Removing what is harmful. And this relates to vengeance. This comes from our animal nature, and it comes from what St. Thomas names the irascible part of our animal nature. So he talks about, in terms of our emotional life, two different sets of responses. One he calls concupiscible, and one he calls irascible. So concupiscible refers to the animal or the human's ability to tend towards what's pleasant by nature and away from what's painful. So, you know, we see we're tired and we see a soft bed with a nice fluffy pillow and we tend towards that pleasant rest, repose. That's through our concupiscible power. And away from something unpleasant. You know, it's a terrible odor, so we move away from it just by this natural inclination. But in addition to this, we and all other animals have a power to move toward things that are unpleasant. We have a power to move towards things that are unpleasant, not because they're unpleasant, because insofar as they're unpleasant, we don't want them. Obviously, we want to stay away from them, but to remove them, right? But you can see this is different. This is a different dynamic. We're moved towards something unpleasant, not to get it for ourselves, but to get rid of it. Take the odor. You know, if you are a homeowner, say, and you smell a moldy smell in your home, then you're moved towards it, not because you like it, but because you want to remove it. You want to find the source and get rid of it. These are obstacles. The things that are unpleasant are obstacles to our attainment of happiness. So we have this irascible power, this power to connect with anger or ira, this power to move towards things that are bad in order to get rid of them. And this relates to vengeance. So the goal towards which we're inclined in this natural inclination to punish or to get vengeance is not pain in itself, right? We're not moved towards the pain as a kind of goal, But what we're moved towards ultimately is the removal of some harmful thing, something bad, something that disrupts or is an obstacle to our happiness, right? And because we need to act in some way or do something to remove it, we're moved in this way through anger to perhaps fight or punish, etc. So someone who's harmed me, an enemy, is, just in terms of nature, is apprehended as a sort of obstacle to my happiness, right? If someone's harmed me, then that person or thing appears as in my field as a sort of obstacle to my happiness. And of course, part of that might be the potential for that person to harm me in the future. But even apart from that, it's simply the presence of this threat or this blemish on my happiness or on my path towards happiness. And thinking about this, maybe we could think about it even on just the basic animal level. Like if you think about two dogs fighting, right? Now, they can't reason through this, but they can have irascible responses. In fact, that's why they're fighting. So imagine that one dog has been hurt by another dog and they're fighting. The dog will, after being hurt, naturally respond and want to hurt back. But it's not so much about causing pain as a reaction or retaliation against being in pain, right? So something evil has been done to me, and there's a sort of natural response to lash out, even on animal level. Now, I don't actually know that much about dog fights, so some of you could perhaps correct me in the question and answer if you have more insight into this. But as far as I know, like if the two dogs are fighting and one clearly wins out and the other one runs away, the victorious dog doesn't need to follow and like inflict more pain on the loser, right? Because he's already accomplished the goal, right? The goal was removal of the obstacle to whatever the alpha dog in the pack or the presence of some threat in the region. Once he's accomplished that goal, he doesn't need to go inflict more pain on that other animal. That's not part of the dynamic here. Only among human animals do we find such cruelty, right? Where we can certainly cite experiences of and imagine others of human beings who do that very thing, who are hurt and want to go back and like inflict more and more pain on the person who's hurt them. I thought of an example. So at University of Dallas, all the freshmen read the Iliad and the Odyssey, very much on their mind. I was teaching freshmen this past semester. So in the Iliad, we see Achilles, after his rival Hector has already been killed, right? He's dead. Achilles dragging the body of Hector on his horse round and round the camp. Now, Hector can't feel anymore. He's dead. He's no longer a threat, obviously. So what's the point, right? I mean, here, this is a clear example, I think, of cruelty, of an excess of desire for punishment. Because Achilles is not satisfied with just killing, but he wants to like denigrate his body. He wants to deny Hector a noble burial, to which he has a right, right? And his father is further sorrowed, not just by the death of his son, but by the fact that he can't yet give him a proper burial. But that's a clear example, I think. But it's not only through a sort of excess in punishing that you can see this excess of vengeance. We have to look at what St. Thomas calls the mind of the avenger. Because someone could punish in a very moderate way, seemingly moderate, and yet be filled with hatred, right? So even if you do exactly the reasonable thing, if you're doing it out of hatred and bitterness, this is excessive. I'm going to read a somewhat longish quotation. This is from St. Thomas, from the Summa Theologiae, question 108 of the second part of the second part, article 1, it's the question on vengeance. So he says, quote, "If the avenger's intention is directed mainly toward what is bad for the one on whom he is taking vengeance, and it rests there, then this is altogether illicit." This is wrong, unlawful. "Since delighting in what is bad for someone involves hatred, which is incompatible with the charity by which we are obligated to love all men, all human beings. Nor is one excused if he intends evil for someone who has unjustly inflicted evil on him, just as no one is excused for hating someone who hates him." On the other hand, if the intention of the one taking retribution is directed mainly towards some good that is attained by punishing the sinner, the wrongdoer, namely towards bettering him, or at least restraining him and bringing tranquility to others, and toward the conservation of justice and of the honor of God, then vengeance, retribution, can be licit as long as the other appropriate circumstances are preserved. That's the end of the quotation. So, I mean, in order to know this, you have to know the mind of the avenger, the mind of the person who is punishing. Is it being done out of hatred or out of love of the good? This makes all the difference. What makes for the virtue here is moderation of the natural inclination by reason, which includes not only how much the wrongdoer is punished, but also in what manner, and most importantly, why, with what intention. If retribution is taken not for the sake of seeing the person suffer, but for restraint, for tranquility, for the good, then retribution can be blameless and even virtuous. So you'll notice that this is very similar to Socrates' position, only St. Thomas is already bringing in the virtue of charity. But in terms of conclusions, this is pretty much what Socrates was getting at, I think. The goal is not to see someone suffer. The goal is the good of the community, but also of that person, the very person who's done wrong. This is the rational way of taking vengeance, the rational form that vengeance would take in a human agent, which kind of forms that, you know, animal matter of our anger, of our appetite for revenge. Okay, so having dwelt a little bit on just what vengeance is as a kind of natural and even rational phenomenon, now let's look at it in light of the gospel. So I'm going to read a passage, short passage from Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount, verses 38 to 42. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to him who begs from you, and do not refuse him who would borrow from you." Do not resist one who is evil. The injunction that Jesus is referring to, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is found in Exodus chapter 21, known as this saying, known as the Lex Talionis, the law of retaliation, of giving what one has gotten. I'll read you what Exodus 21 says in verse 24. "If any harm follows from someone striking another, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." Again, that's Exodus 21, verse 24. Now, if it weren't for the fact that Jesus had said earlier in Matthew 5, "I come not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them," we might be forgiven for thinking that he was abolishing the Lex Talionis, because it kind of sounds like that, right? So instead of saying an eye for an eye, he says, "Do not resist one who is evil." And that sounds almost diametrically opposed to an eye for an eye. So what's going on here? Well, in fact, there have been a number of attempts, both in the early church and then in modern times as well, to read the saying of Jesus as, in fact, an abrogation rather than a fulfillment. In other words, as basically saying, that was bad, that the Lex Talionis was evil, and now I'm going to give you something good in place of that. But that's actually not the orthodox position. That is, it's not the accepted Christian reading of that passage. I think I'll skip over some of the less orthodox readings. But, if you're interested, in fact, Leo Tolstoy, it's interesting, wrote a book on the gospel teaching, and offered a rather radical interpretation that said, you know, if Christians were really doing what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, they would not be taking any vengeance ever. Right? They would completely abstain from taking vengeance. There would be no violence, no wars, no punishment. Now, Tolstoy did leave open an idea of nonviolent resistance. So I think he was, I was kind of cheating a little bit because, or at least there's a sort of inconsistency here. Because actually what Jesus says is, he doesn't say, don't resist in a violent way. He says, do not resist when it is evil, period. Nonviolent resistance is a good thing, but it's maybe not clear that that's exactly what's going on in Matthew 5:39. So if you're interested, we could talk about more about that in, at the end, question and answer. To get a more orthodox reading, and the one that came down to St. Thomas Aquinas, and he uses it to guide his own commentary on this passage, we'll turn to St. Augustine. So St. Augustine wrote a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, and he answers in some detail this kind of objection. And there's really the twofold objection. So on the one hand, you have people saying, well, now if you really did that, we couldn't have society. Like, we'd have anarchy. If we never resisted when it was evil, if we never punished people who stole and killed and perjured, you know, society would be in chaos, anarchy. And actually, that was what some pagan thinkers said in Augustine's time. They said, you Christians, you know, you don't really follow this. If you did, we wouldn't have society. On the other hand, then there's the question of, well, what do we do with what Jesus is saying here in light of the Old Testament? Are they simply contradicting each other? Do we have to just throw out the old and replace it with the new? So Augustine masterfully answers both of those objections. And I'll try to just summarize, I'll quote a little bit from his own analysis and summarize some other parts to show what he does here. So to correct a wrongdoer, Augustine thinks, is an act of mercy when it's undertaken out of love and not out of hatred. And he compares it to a father correcting his son. In fact, that's Augustine's model for the Christian take on punishment. The model is a father and son, or a parent and child. So this is a quotation from book one of the Lord's Sermon on the Mount, the commentary. Augustine says, this, therefore, is all that is required, that he do the punishing who in the natural order of things is invested with the power to do so, and that he punish with the benevolence of a father towards his young child, whom because of his youth he cannot yet hate. Clearly, from here we can draw the best example to show to satisfaction that wrongdoing can better be punished in a spirit of love than be left unpunished, that the one who punishes does not wish the one punished to be unhappy by the punishment, but happy through the correction he receives. But at the same time, he is ready, the one giving the punishment, is ready, if need be, to put up calmly with further annoyance on the part of him whose improvement he desires. So just like a father who's going to correct the young son, but not to get back at him, or not out of a kind of vengeful bitterness, and certainly not out of hatred, instead out of desire for the good of the one being corrected. Far from being a source of anarchy, then, the gospel teaching is actually describing the state of soul most calculated to preserve and further the civic good. For by the good man's patience, quote, the evil man is overcome, or rather, evil is overcome by good in the evil man. And nothing is more useful to the state than the overcoming of evil through repentance. Nothing could be more conducive to the civic order. So much for the objection that this gospel teaching leads to anarchy, but what about the relationship between do not resist evil and the lex talionis? Has Jesus simply done away with retaliation? Is vengeance now evil, whereas before it was good? Well, Augustine, typically to his way of interpreting scripture, argues for the harmony between the old and the new, right? So he wants to show that they both are true, but they speak to different times and different levels of perfection. So he says the lex talionis was good, but imperfect. Very important. Good, but imperfect. The gospel teaching is good and perfect. It's the perfection of the old. So how is the lex talionis good? How is an eye for an eye good? Well, Augustine comments, this, what he calls the morality of the Pharisees, is not to exceed due measure in revenge, not to pay back more than you have received. And he says, quote, this is really a high level. For you do not easily find a person content to return only blow for blow, or make only one reply to the word of the man scoffing at him, and that just enough to match him. By these words, moderation is indicated. Revenge is not to exceed the wrong due. So if you try to make this concrete in your own imagination, you know, imagine that the worst insult that someone could say to you, imagine someone's like insulted you, just low, a low blow. And then imagine, you don't have to be really a quick thinker for this to work, but imagine that two responses immediately occur to you. And one of them is just exactly proportioned. Like you say, you're going to say something back that's just exactly equal in insult to the person who insulted you, okay? But the other response is better. Do you think of one, like, I could go one up and, oh yeah, your mother. So you're faced with this choice between the proportional response is just exactly equal to the injury and the one that's a little bit better, right? Now, which one of us would easily choose the lesser insult when we had the better comeback, right? That's quite a bit of self-restraint that would be required there. Virtue even, or at least, you know, something approaching virtue would be required there. And certainly it would be moderate. But as moderate and perhaps virtuous as this response would be, Augustine says, it's a high level, but there's something higher. There's something superior. Not only to place a limit on retaliation, but to forego it freely. He says, quote, the Lex Talionis is the beginning of peace, but perfect peace is to have no desire at all for such revenge, not to want personal vengeance. But how do we do this? How do we put this precept into practice? Doesn't it mean that we do forego our ability to punish people? Like, how can I say I'm not going to resist evil? I'm going to strive not to desire revenge, and yet sometimes punish people who do wrong? So in order to understand this, Augustine looks to the lives of holy people, saints, especially those recorded in the scriptures, in order to interpret how we're supposed to apply this. Now, he is helped here by the fact that he can look to the example of not just a saint, but Jesus himself. So in the Gospels, we read about Jesus before the high priest in his passion. This is the same Jesus, the same Lord who told us not to resist evil. So we look at him. He also said, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. But what does Jesus do when the slave of the high priest strikes him on one cheek? He doesn't offer the other cheek. He doesn't do that. Instead, he replies with a strong word. He says, if I have spoken evil, charge me with evil. If well, why are you striking me? You know, so he responds strongly and with a rebuke. He doesn't turn the other cheek in that instance. Now, clearly, Jesus is not disobeying his own precept. He's showing us that this precept doesn't mean never saying a strong word or never punishing someone. But one has to attend to the time and the place. St. Paul, so second example in scripture itself, is St. Paul, who, when he is before the high priest and gets slapped again on the cheek, he doesn't turn the other cheek. Instead, he says, God shall strike you, you whitewashed wall, he says to the one who slapped him. So both Jesus and St. Paul show us that we're not to take this in such a literal way that we would conclude that we can never strike out against one who has struck us. But in fact, as St. Augustine is going to say a little more clearly in a minute, we have to have a certain disposition which is ready to suffer injury against ourselves, and at the same time be ready to correct those who do wrong when we have the responsibility to do so. This is a quote from Augustine again. This is the Christian rule of conduct. When an indignity has been received, the mind is not to be excited into hatred, but taking compassion on the weakness shown, it is to show itself ready to suffer more, nor is it to neglect correction, to which end it may employ either advice or authority or force. force is the same as violence there. So, you know, sometimes correction, which is a kind of compassion, might require violence. So in other words, the Christian must be prepared in his mind to endure whatever evils his enemy might inflict on him. But he must also be prepared to resist and correct when it's demanded by his position or the common good. But even so, he cannot do it out of hatred, but rather out of love for the offender and of the community. So this Christian response that I'm trying to articulate with Augustine's help here is a kind of dual response. It combines a readiness to suffer, especially injuries against oneself, with a zeal for the good, a zeal for justice, right? Hunger and thirst for righteousness. This is part of it. This is what it means, part of what it means to imitate Christ, whose zeal for the Father's house caused him to drive the money changers out of the temple, which was clearly a kind of vengeance. And at the same time, to, for those very same enemies, and many others, for all of us, in fact, who, insofar as we're sinners, are enemies of God, he was willing to go to the cross and to suffer innocently for those who were his enemies in order to make them his friends, to reestablish them in a loving relationship with God. We can also look not only to the examples from the scriptures, but from the lives of the saints after the New Testament, including Augustine himself. So I love this example because it shows that Augustine put into practice in some painful circumstances what he was preaching, which is what we all hope to do. So one of the things Augustine had to deal with as a bishop, so he's Bishop of Hippo in North Africa, he had to deal with a number of schisms and heresies, among which the Donatists occupied much of his time and energy. And this heresy seemed to have been centered in 4th century North Africa, not in the whole church. But for Augustine, like, this was a very pressing problem. He spent a lot of time and energy on this. Well, this was a sect which had separated from the Orthodox response because of the apostasy of some Christians, right? So the Donatists claimed that the Christians who, under the persecution of Diocletian, had apostatized, had to be rebaptized, right? Like, they couldn't just be welcomed back in. They had to basically start all over and be rebaptized. And they also taught that the efficacy of the sacraments depended on the holiness of the minister of the sacrament. And so for both of these reasons, they departed from Christian orthodoxy and had to be condemned. But apparently the Donatists also were kind of irascible folks, and some of them at least used violence against Catholic priests and bishops and faithful. And at first Augustine thought, okay, well, I'll write letters, you know, I'll preach sermons, I'll let them be fined in order to kind of curb this difficult response. But it wasn't working. So when the milder remedies failed and the Donatists continued violent attacks, so some of the clergy were fearful of their lives, Augustine eventually came to agree with the majority of bishops in North Africa that it was necessary to bring in the secular arm, right, to allow the state to use some coercion in order to get the Donatists to come back to the fold. One historian and Augustinian scholar, James O'Donnell, writes that Augustine, quote, consented to the new policy, right, the use of violence and force, when he became convinced that the perversity and obtuseness of the Donatists were complete. Even charity itself demanded that they be compelled to enter the true church in the hope that at least some would genuinely benefit from the change. They could not be worse off than they were, right? So they had run out of other options. So here we see Augustine living out his interpretation of Matthew 5:39. Do not resist evil does not mean never correcting those who are resisting you. But it means it's a last resort to use violence, certainly. And he's ready. Augustine demonstrated in his episcopacy that he was ready to suffer the attacks of those who were against him for the good of them and also his flock, but that he was also prepared to sanction punishment if the common good seemed to require it. to move to the conclusion now. So I want to return to the original question and try to summarize in 4 points a Christian approach to vengeance, and then illustrate with one final example. So the original question, remember, was, is it wrong to want the bad guy to suffer? So we can say 4 things. First, to want someone to suffer for the sake of watching him suffer is bad. That's hatred, leads to cruelty. That's a vice. We should try to avoid that. 2, to want evil actions to be punished is good. Right? This actually pertains to a desire for justice. So it's good just on the natural level to want evil to be punished. Doesn't mean that we have to want to be the ones to punish it, but that to want it to be somehow addressed is good. 3rd point, to want someone to suffer for the sake of his own good, for the sake of becoming better, is virtuous and good. In fact, it's the good of friendship. So to exercise friendship is to will the good of another person. Right? So sometimes that good might involve pain. And so just like the father correcting his child or the mother correcting her child, to want, not for the sake of the pain, but to want the one you are friendly towards, the one you love, to suffer this punishment is actually an act of friendship. And that's a high level, but not the highest. So 4th point, and I think this is the explicitly Christian point and the one that goes beyond even Socrates, even friendship, to want to suffer with and for someone for the sake of his becoming better, that's not just friendship, it's not just good, that's charity. It's divinely good, right? To want to suffer for someone else's good, even one's enemy's good. I mean, this is what Jesus does for us on the cross, suffers for those who are estranged from himself, from God. So insofar as we do that, we're striving to imitate Christ, to be willing to suffer even for our enemies, even for those who hate us. This is a high calling, not possible without grace. I want to end with one more example. This one comes from a biography I just read about St. Anselm of Canterbury, written by his friend and associate Aadmer. So he was a contemporary of Anselm. Anselm died in 1109, so he's a little bit before St. Thomas Aquinas. Anselm was a Benedictine monk who was named Archbishop of Canterbury, an office he tried quite vigorously to resist, but they convinced him in the end that God wanted it. He resisted it out of humility, but also I think because he knew he would be tried. He would be involved in politics with the king, and that the King of England was perhaps not in all ways sympathetic to the needs of and the privileges of the church. And he was quite right about being hesitant there, because this is the time of William the Conqueror. William the Conqueror died. Anselm was becoming archbishop, and his son, also named William, so this is William Rufus or William II, becomes King of England. Well, William II was not a big fan of Archbishop Anselm, to put it mildly, and they were continually at loggerheads throughout the life of King William II. So Aadmer, the biographer, quotes King William as saying, in response to some messengers that Anselm had sent to him, King William said, "Yesterday I hated him with great hatred. Today I hate him with yet greater hatred. And he can be certain that tomorrow and thereafter I shall hate him continually with ever fiercer and more bitter hatred. I utterly refuse to regard him any longer as father or archbishop. As to his blessings and prayers, I do utterly abominate them and spew them from me." It's hard to imagine a clearer expression of animosity, quite outright hatred. Given this disposition of the king, it's probably not surprising that Anselm ended up going to exile. So he went back to his homeland, to Italy, and remained there until King William II had died. So that was about 3 years in his first exile from England. But Anselm, or clearly William is an enemy to Anselm, but Anselm has no bitterness towards the king, even the king who has driven him into exile. Aadmer also reports that it was Anselm who, at the Council of Bari, convinced the Pope not to excommunicate William, right? So the Pope wanted to excommunicate him, but Anselm apparently convinced him to go with a gentler punishment. Further, Admir reports to us St. Anselm's reaction when he heard of the death of King William II. Quote, "At this news, Anselm was utterly stupefied and burst into bitter tears. We onlookers were somewhat surprised. But he declared, in words broken with sobs, that if it had been possible, he would much rather that his own body had died than that the king died in his present state." I think that was truly meant. Now, Anselm did want William to be corrected, and he, you know, conferred with the Pope about how best to do that, because William was not respecting the rights and property of the church. But he didn't want William's eternal loss, which is another way of saying he wanted his eternal good. Right? He wanted him to be saved. He didn't want him to die in a state of hatred and enmity. This is as fine an example as we could wish of the paternal disposition that Augustine described. So here's a bishop being a real father to the king who is part of his flock, like a father toward his young child, whom in spite of his disobedience and outright hatred, he cannot hate. Right? He cannot hate his son. I want to end with, St. Anselm wrote a prayer for his enemies. Prayer for enemies. I think he actually wrote this before he became archbishop, but we see that he really lived it out. So I want to read a part of this prayer as a conclusion here. So Anselm prays to God, "You who are the true light, lighten their darkness, the darkness of my enemies. You who are the whole truth, correct their errors. You who are the true life, give life to their souls. So I pray, Lord, that you will give them love for you and love for their neighbor, as far as you ordain that they should have it, lest they should sin before you against their brother. This is the punishment that in the secret of my heart I want to exact on those who serve with me and those who sin with me. This is the punishment that I ask for those who serve with me and hate me. Let us love you and each other as you will and is expedient for us, so that we may make amends to the good Lord for our own and for each other's offenses, so that we may obey with one heart in love, one Lord and one Master. This is the revenge your sinner asks on all who wish him evil and act against him. Most merciful Lord, prepare the same punishment of me, your sinner."
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.